Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. President Barack Obama went to Capitol Hill Friday to make a last-minute appeal to fellow Democrats to support his ambitious Asia-Pacific free trade agenda ahead of a key vote in the House of Representatives on whether to extend crucial fast-track negotiating authority to the White House. As of Friday morning, it was still not clear whether the bill had enough support from House Democrats, many of whom are concerned the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, trade deal would send more American jobs overseas and hurt the environment. The fast-track legislation, known as Trade Promotional Authority, or TPA, would allow the White House to negotiate the 12-nation Asian Trade Pact and others like it without letting Congress make any changes in the deals when they come up for approval or rejection. An American labor union says hackers are now in possession of sensitive personnel information on all federal employees following a major cyber intrusion that U.S. officials say originated in China. The American Federation of Government Employees said in a letter to the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, the federal government's human resources agency that was targeted, that hackers have personnel data on all federal retirees and former employees. The OPM said last week, as many as 4 million current and former federal employees may have been affected by the December hacking. Some U.S. officials and lawmakers say China-based hackers, possibly with links to Beijing, carried out the attack. China dismissed the accusations as irresponsible. This is VOA News. Members of youth vigilante forces in northern Nigeria say the Boko Haram militant group has burned 6 villages and killed 37 people in a new attack near the insurgent stronghold in Zambesa Forest. Government-aligned vigilantes told reporters Friday that the attacks took place late on Wednesday. The Nigerian newspaper The Nation reported that the villages were all in Borno State. Reports published Friday show U.S. consumers becoming more optimistic, while inflation rose a bit from very low levels. Data from University of Michigan surveys of consumers show they were encouraged by the improving outlook for jobs and lower gasoline prices. Those energy prices have been bouncing upward a bit recently, and that helped the Labor Department's measure of inflation at the wholesales level rise 0.5%, which is the fastest pace in nearly 3 years. Outside the volatile areas of food and energy, inflation rose just 0.6% over the past year. A French court has acquitted former International Monetary Fund chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn of pimping charges in a trial that has gripped France and cast a spotlight on the seamy underside of power in politics. For VOA, Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
Many were not surprised by the verdict handed down by a court in the northern French city of Lille. It cleared former IMF head Dominique Strauss-Kahn and a dozen other defendants involved in sex parties with prostitutes that took place in France and in Washington, D.C. Even the prosecutor asked for Strauss-Kahn's acquittal, saying the charges of aggravated pimping could not be proved. The verdict ends 4 years of legal headaches for Strauss-Kahn, which began in 2011 when a New York hotel maid accused him of sexually assaulting her. Those charges were eventually dropped, and later he came to a separate civil agreement with his accuser, Nafissatou Diallo. Strauss-Kahn has since tried to repair his image, but many analysts believe his political career is over. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
U.S. authorities say two men accused of plotting to attack police officers in Massachusetts are being charged with conspiracy to provide material support to Islamic State militants. A U.S. Justice Department statement named the accused as David W. Wright, 25, of Everett, Massachusetts, and Nicholas Ravinsky, 24, of Warwick, Rhode Island. The statement said the men have been plotting to commit attacks and kill persons inside the United States, which they believe would support Islamic State's objectives. And a German federal prosecutor say they have closed a year-long probe into the alleged wiretapping of Chancellor Angela Merkel's cell phone by the U.S. National Security Agency. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
In some places in the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, refugees and migrants follow railroad tracks, mountain routes. They walk for days. Sometimes they're subjected to train accidents because they're walking along train tracks.
That's Kitty McKinsky of the UN Refugee Agency, who says refugees and migrants in the Western Balkans are facing growing risks.
Also, Islamic State jihadists in Libya are rapidly growing in strength and are being directed by highly experienced commanders. And the heads of five West African nations met in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, to coordinate a regional force to combat the six-year Boko Haram insurgency.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Senegal, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Libyan militiamen battling the Islamic State's affiliate in their country say most of the jihadi fighters are not Libyans. The bulk of them come from neighboring North African nations, but they warn the jihadis are rapidly growing in strength and are being directed by highly experienced commanders. Jamie Detmer reports from the city of Misrata.
In an out-of-the-way, tightly secured camp, fighters from one of Misrata's top militias are reflecting on their recent defeat at the hands of Islamic extremists. Late last month, the Islamic State's new affiliate in Libya overran the coastal city of Sirte, the hometown of deposed Libyan strongman Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, who was ousted in a NATO-backed uprising 4 years ago. Abu Khalijazi is a commander and spokesman for the 166th Brigade, which was in the vanguard of the battle starting in mid-March to keep Sirte out of the hand of the jihadis. He says fighting the Islamic State, he uses the Arab acronym DAESH for the group, is different from fighting he experienced in the uprising against Gaddafi and in the fighting since in Libya, which is currently divided between two rival governments. He says DAESH prefers to avoid direct confrontations and there aren't really front lines with them. The jihadis like to launch surprise outflanking attacks in the dead of night. The DAESH fighters mainly come from Mali, Mauritania, Syria, Algeria, Egypt and a lot from Tunisia, he says. The 166th Brigade fighters are clearly shocked at their defeat. They prefer to describe it as a tactical retreat, and they're fearful about what comes next from DAESH. Last week, IS fighters expanded their hold on a stretch of the Mediterranean coast of Libya across from Italy by taking another town near Sirte, and to the west of Sirte they captured this week a major power plant. Forces loyal to the self-declared government based in the capital, Tripoli, withdrew from the plant after three soldiers were killed, another so-called tactical retreat that suggests even veterans from the uprising against Gaddafi are ill-prepared to take on DAESH. Since the start of the year, the Islamic State has claimed responsibility for slaughtering dozens of Egyptian and Ethiopian Christians, as well as an attack on Tripoli's landmark Corinthia Hotel, which left 10 dead, including an American security contractor. They bombed embassies too, and mounted bomb and gun attacks on checkpoints more than 241 kilometres from Sirte on the outskirts of Misrata. The Islamic State has capitalised on the general turmoil in Libya, where two governments are vying for power, a self-declared one in Tripoli and an internationally recognised one now based in Tobruk. UN-sponsored peace talks look all but hopeless. Meanwhile, the Islamic State, estimated by Libyan militiamen to have under 3,000 fighters currently, is threatening to turn its foothold into a much larger presence. The leader of an Islamic militant group, Ansar al-Sharia, in the town of Derna, Thursday, declared his allegiance to DAESH. Abdi Mohammed Gaid is a former member of the anti-Gaddafi Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which was based out of Afghanistan for a time, but refused a request by al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden to join him. His brother did, though, and became a prominent member of al-Qaeda before being killed in an American drone strike. Now a member of the Tripoli-based parliament, he says the seed of Daesh has been planted. He warns if it isn't confronted quickly, it will grow much stronger and be harder to uproot. Jamie Detmer for VOA News, Misrata.
Migrants from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia and Eritrea are taking a new route to Western Europe. Once they reach Greece, they then travel through the West Balkans. The UN Refugee Agency says so far this year, more than 22,000 migrants have entered Serbia. That's a six-fold increase from last year. Kitty McKenzie is a spokesperson for the UNHCR. From Budapest, Hungary, she talks to VOA's David Arnold about some of the problems facing the migrants and refugees traveling through the West Balkans.
People are coming from the same places you just mentioned, Syria, Afghanistan, Eritrea, Somalia. So it's war zones in Africa and other places. The numbers that we're talking about are just a huge increase. So a fourfold increase between 2012 and 2014 in asylum seekers arriving through the Western Balkans. In 22,000 asylum claims lodged in 2015 just in Serbia. And then, just in the month of May, 10,000. By any measure, this is an extremely large number.
What are some of the risks that these migrants are experiencing that perhaps are a little unique to the Western Balkans?
This is the real thing that we're very worried about. People are putting themselves in extreme dangers, just as you've seen in the Mediterranean, that people risk drowning. In some places in the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, refugees and migrants follow railroad tracks, mountain routes. They walk for days. Sometimes they're subjected to train accidents because they're walking along train tracks. There have been a number of fatal accidents over the past few months, and this reminds us what horrible dangers there are for these young children and women who are so desperate just to find a safe haven in Europe.
Where do most of the migrants come from, and where do most of them want to go?
They're fleeing war zones like Syria, Afghanistan. They're fleeing human rights violations in Eritrea. Some of them are coming from Somalia. They're desperate to save their lives, to get away from human rights abuses, and they're trying to get to Western Europe. Many of them end up coming through Serbia into Hungary, which is where I'm speaking to you from. I've been to the border between Serbia and Hungary. I've seen young men with their feet just bloody and bruised and with horrible calluses because they've walked for days and days and days.
Is this just another way of getting into Europe?
From what we've seen, and I've talked to some of these people as they're making their way into Hungary, you know, they've come through the Western Balkans, mainly they're trying to get to safety. They are very well informed. Their smugglers tell them where they're going. They know to call a phone number in Austria. They know exactly where they want to end up. The issue is not probably trying to deter people from entering. People are fleeing because of the persecution and the war in their homelands. It's not so much the attraction of where they're going to, it's the dangers where they're fleeing. And so I don't think we're going to have any success trying to deter the people from fleeing. It's a question of receiving them in a decent and humane way and trying to manage the flows. And if we could, stop all these wars that are going on that are sending people towards our shores.
Is there an asylum process?
All of these countries do have an asylum process, and we've been working, we, the UN Refugee Agency, have been working with the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia to try to get improvement. There are some changes that have gone that need to be approved by Parliament. Now we think that things like these deaths that we've seen point to the urgent need for them to be adopted and implemented. In Serbia, the situation's a bit more positive, and the problem is that the system's just a bit overwhelmed. Asylum seekers are received well, but then the process for determining whether they really need international protection works a little slowly. We would like to see a lot of improvement in the systems, but all of these countries do have refugee status determination systems in place, and so they do have, at least on paper and sometimes operationally a system for receiving people who file asylum claims and for processing them. There are political parties in some of them that want to agitate against foreigners. Some people want to make refugees scapegoats. But in general, they have the processes in place and they are keeping their borders open. In today's world, that is something that deserves commendation. What we're concerned about is just the fact that so many people are on the move. For example, the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, that people find it necessary to move in the dark, follow train tracks, and that the people are getting killed while doing this.
That was Kitty McKinsey of the UN Refugee Agency from Budapest. She spoke to VOA's David Arnold.
Kenya says it wants 100,000 Somali refugees to return to Somalia in the next 6 months. Deputy Vice President William Ruto has announced the government wants to reduce by one-third the number of refugees at Dadaab refugee camp, which now houses more than 300,000 Somalis. More than 2,000 have voluntarily returned to Somalia since December, and Ruto says he hopes 98,000 will also volunteer to return home by the end of 2015. Kenya seeks drastic reductions at Dadaab, which Ruto claims is a source of criminal activity and recruitment of al-Shabaab fighters. Al-Shabaab fighters from neighboring Somalia have attacked Kenyan civilians since Nairobi sent troops to support an African Union force to combat Shabaab rebels in Somalia. Dadaab is one of two camps in Kenya where the World Food Program has been forced to reduce refugee rations due to lack of international donations.
The heads of five West African nations met in Nigeria's capital Abuja to coordinate a regional force to combat the six-year Boko Haram insurgency. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari says the five-nation force will be led by a Nigerian general, a deputy from Cameroon, and a chief of staff from Chad. Mr. Buhari says the force will increase to 8,500 troops. Nigeria has pledged $30 million for regional headquarters operations in Chad's capital, N'Djamena. More than 1.5 million Nigerians have been displaced and thousands have died during Boko Haram's campaign to take control of three northeast provinces. A month ago, Nigerian forces invaded the Sambisa forest, where rebels are believed to have large encampments. Since then, Boko Haram has increased suicide bombings and other hit-and-run tactics in Nigeria's northeast. Today, survivors say 37 have died and six Nigerian villages have been burned to the ground near the edge of the Sambisa forest.
Eighteen minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. In recent years, the economic outlook for many developing countries appeared bright, but the World Bank has lowered its expectations for 2015, saying they now face a series of tough challenges. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The World Bank projects developing countries will grow by 4.4% this year, instead of the earlier forecast of 4.8%. Ayhan Kirsa, director of the bank's Development Prospects Group, gives a major reason why prospects dimmed this year.
Developing countries as a group have been slowing down since 2010. It's fair to say that. But what happened in 2014 and a part of this year, a significant drop in oil prices started weighing on activity, especially in oil-exporting economies.
The World Bank's Global Economic Prospects Report outlines problems in the so-called emerging economies.
Brazil, now we are expecting, is going to have a recession. Russia is going through a painful recession. Both of those are big emerging market economies. And you look at the emerging market economies, for example, China is going through an orderly slowdown. South Africa has serious structural bottlenecks. All of these, when you put them together, led to a forecast revision.
Kirsa says bad news for developing oil exporting countries is good news for importers.
It is a windfall for the global economy. And we still think that the benefits of oil price decline will be materialized during the next 12 to 18 months. For oil exporting economies, it's a painful adjustment, but for oil importing economies, there's no question it's a positive development.
The decline in oil prices is causing a global economic shift.
Ultimately, with the decline in oil price, what you see is a real income transfer from oil exporting economies to oil importing economies, the consumers, the spenders.
The World Bank official says, however, consumers are still hesitant to use their savings from lower oil prices to buy things. Spending spurs economies, but there's still a lack of consumer confidence. So what about those oil exporting developing countries like Nigeria and Angola that pin their hopes on their oil reserves?
For this year, we reduced our growth forecast for Nigeria and Angola. And in both countries, you see policy adjustment as well. Nigeria reduced their expenditures, the fiscal spending. Angola, they reduced the fiscal spending. They are taking measures to adjust to this new environment. At the same time, over the medium term, we expect them to think about diversification, to think about more investment in infrastructure, investment in human capital.
Cursus says while diversification may be a painful process for Nigeria and Angola, in the long term, it could help them weather future economic shocks. For example, investing in non-oil sectors could allow them to have more trading partners. The bank's forecast for the turmoil-plagued Middle East and North Africa is just 2.2% this year. Officials are monitoring the various crises, saying they could trigger a rise in oil prices. Another factor expected to negatively affect many developing nations is the predicted rise in U.S. interest rates.
The U.S. interest rates are the reference interest rates. When the U.S. short-term policy rate increases, that has an impact for the cost of borrowing at different maturities. So it can have a widespread effect across the different interest rates, consumers and firms at which they are borrowing, and it will have an impact on the cost of international borrowing as well.
A region that's the exception to the World Bank forecast for developing nations is South Asia. It has a projected growth rate of 7.1% this year.
South Asia is becoming the fastest growing region. The main driver of that is India, with strong monetary policy framework, willingness to undertake reforms. All of these send a very strong signal that medium-term growth prospects are going to get stronger.
The World Bank Global Economic Prospects Report is more optimistic for 2016 and 2017. Growth forecasts for developing countries for those 2 years are 5.2% and 5.4% respectively. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A new online tool was launched this week that allows farmers, extension workers, and agro dealers across Kenya to learn in just minutes information on varieties of popular crops like maize, pigeon pea, and cassava. It will tell them the best choice for local growing conditions, how to avoid crop disease, and the best way to cook the crop. Paul Wanyanga is CEO of Kenya Markets Trust, a supporter of the new website. He spoke with me from Nairobi about the website called Mbegu Choice, the first tool of its kind in sub-Saharan Africa.
The whole idea is to provide correct information to farmers. You would like to know that agriculture contributes in Kenya. Agriculture contributes 51% to the GDP, both directly and indirectly. So it is a very important sector of the country's economy. So clearly what has happened is there hasn't been enough information flowing into farmers. And there are not many large-scale farmers. A lot of farmers are basically in the small category where they're doing to a large extent, subsistence farming. Without the correct information, clearly the food security situation in our country is obviously very much threatened because we really are a net importer. We import large sums of food on an annual basis at this rate, whilst we believe and think that the country can be able to sufficiently grow its own food.
For example, if a farmer wants to know the best growing conditions for maize or pigeon pea, what would he or she need to do once they get onto the website?
First of all, it's a very simple, very friendly website. We've divided our country from a governance structure into 47 counties. So the first question would be, which county is your farm? As soon as he or she answers that, there will be a lead on, you know, the ecological zone within the county, and that's already predetermined on the website. And then a particular person who is inquiring, what crop? Is one cassava, maize, sorghum? And they would actually input that. And they will also be asked of the special attributes that they would like of the particular crop. And we have two sets of rains in Kenya. You know, some parts of the country, it only rains once for a long period, but once. In some other parts of the country, it rains twice. So that question will be asked of the particular person inquiring, asking, do you want this crop for the long rains or you want it for the two short rains? Just really like when you're filling a form and you're getting prompted, that's the way the website has been laid out. The results of that inquiry would show the varieties of seed that the person should be interested in, when that variety was put in the market, who does it, in what quantity it is packaged in, and that kind of information to help the person inquiring to make a decision.
At this point, how many crop varieties are in the database?
Well over 200 commercialized crop varieties right now. 61 of these are related to maize, 25 are related to common bean, 11 are of cassava. We have Irish potato, 13 of them, and 12 are sorghum. In other words, all the ones I have mentioned are actually what you call food crops, because we think that is where we must begin this process, because food crop, of course, is critical for the country to feed itself. And then as we progress, we know seed is not the only item that you need to get a successful yield. We will be developing other areas, like, for example, the agrochemicals that are desirable in terms of fertilizer and pesticides and whatever.
How do rural farmers, how do they get access to the database?
First of all, the mobile phone penetration is exceedingly high. It doesn't mean that if a farmer has a mobile phone, which most of them have, whether they are literate or illiterate. We're talking about 3/4 of the population with cell phones. But, you know, they may just be using cell phones for basic use of voice, you know, and not having to go towards the data processing. I mean, data processing is slightly different, and also it depends on the kind of phone that you have. If it's not a smartphone, obviously, then you will not be able to work with it on the internet or use data. We know that it's a journey. There will be some farmers, clearly, that who will not be clearly able to access on their cell phones or do not even have computers, because a lot of these seeds are available in agrovet shops, you know, shops specifically that sell agrochemicals and seeds. Each one of these shops that we're talking about throughout the country will, of course, be accessing this information. And farmers always will go into those shops because they have to get their supplies, especially when it's a planting season. We primarily are looking towards the agrovet shops to be the primary drivers of this thinking, especially in the very remote areas of Kenya, which will still have agrovet shops. That's how we intend to drive this agenda.
Paul Wanyaga is CEO of Kenya Markets Trust. He spoke with me from Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehei Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
On Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This This one I get you. This one I get you.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Islamic State jihadis in Libya are rapidly growing in strength and are being directed by highly experienced commanders. The UN Refugee Agency says so far this year more than 22,000 migrants have entered Serbia, and the heads of five West African nations met in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, to coordinate a regional force to combat the six-year Boko Haram insurgency. Coming up, we'll have music from Senegal, and in our feature segment, the government of Liberia discusses plans for building a national monument to remember the thousands who died of Ebola. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning with pro basketball.
Kim, let's tip off with the National Basketball Association Finals. The visiting Golden State Warriors defeated the Cleveland Cavaliers 103-82 to even the best-of-seven championship series at two games each. After three close games, this was the most lopsided contest in the NBA Finals. League Most Valuable Player Stephen Curry scored 22 points for Golden State. He says the Warriors approach Game 4 with a must-win attitude.
Since Game 1, I think we've had spurts where, obviously, the last quarter in Game 3, and the last 3 minutes of Game 2, we got to our identity, but it was a little too late. Tonight, we came in with the mentality that, obviously, like we were saying, that we had to win this game. So it was about effort and consistent effort every possession. It's obviously not perfect. We still can play a little bit better, I think. But the effort was at a level that it erased some of those mistakes, and we just battled from the start. So we gave ourselves a shot, and then shots go in. Everybody starts to feel good. You pick up some momentum.
Steph Curry and the Warriors appear to have picked up some momentum as the NBA Finals move west for Game 5 Sunday night in Oakland, California. Warriors coach Steve Kerr made a surprising move in Game 4. He replaced his big Australian center, Andrew Bogut, in the starting lineup with swingman Andre Iguodala, who has Nigerian blood on his father's side. And Andre came through for the Warriors with 22 points in Game 4. At the post-game news conference, Coach Kerr was brutally honest in talking about his decision.
When I was asked today, I think Tim Kawakami asked me if Bogut was starting, I lied. No, I did. I mean, I lied. So, I figure I have two press conferences on the day of the game, so I'm asked a lot of strategic questions. So my options were tell the truth, and I was asked both at shoot around and before the game. So if I tell the truth, it's the equivalent of me knocking on David Blatt's door and say, hey, this is what we're going to do. I could evade the question, which would start this Twitter phenomenon, who's going to start for the Warriors? Or I could lie, so I lied. Sorry, but I don't think they hand you the trophy for based on morality. They give it to you if you win. So sorry about that.
Head coach Steve Kerr of the Golden State Warriors, who will host the Cleveland Cavaliers Sunday night in Game 5 of the NBA Finals, which are tied at two games each. Meanwhile, Cameroonian player Luke Richard Mbamute of the NBA's Philadelphia 76ers club is participating in a zero-cases tackle Ebola campaign aimed at curbing the spread of the deadly disease. I called Luke in the southwestern U.S. city of Houston, Texas, and I asked him, why did you decide to join this fight against Ebola?
I decided to join it because it hit home. I'm from Africa, and especially Cameroon, but I feel like I'm a representation of Africa where I'm at. I'm one of the ambassadors of the continent. And I joined this campaign to encourage people in the United States to fight against Ebola and to try to reach newer cases. You know, the world needs to keep fighting because the fight is still on. It's not over. And we want to get to zero cases. And that's why, as an ambassador, I try to push so people in America can help us get to zero cases.
As you mentioned, Luke, you're from Cameroon. The Ebola epidemic has not really touched Cameroon, but it has caused more than 11,000 deaths in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. In fact, just this week, some more cases were revealed in Sierra Leone and Guinea. Did the scope of this epidemic surprise you?
Yeah. I mean, in Cameroon, I remember growing up, we had something a little similar, but it wasn't as bad. We had some cases of Ebola, but it wasn't as alarming as it is now. You know, to have this many people suffer and kill is very, very surprising. It's very hurtful. That's why we need to continue to fight and continue trying to help bring this epidemic down so that stuff like that don't happen again. And that's the reason why I'm trying to, you know, fight with along with everybody else on this campaign to bring it all down to zero cases.
Serge Ibaka from the Oklahoma City Thunder also participating in this Ebola campaign. Luke, what's your relationship with Serge?
I mean, me and Serge, obviously, we came in around the same time in the NBA. And somebody who also really is proud of being African and, you know, wants to help and is about being African and representing his continent in the right way. And we both feel like us being ambassadors and putting our faces and trying to get people in the U.S. to rally behind us to help us trying to get to zero cases is going to benefit our people back home.
Let's talk briefly NBA hoops. Rough season for the 76ers, only 18 wins. Do you expect things will improve next season?
I think we'll improve. You know, we had 18 wins this season. We started off really bad, losing 17 games in a row. But you look at the way the team is built, it's a lot of young players, young, talented players. And those guys all got better by the end of the season. And, you know, it's good to see those guys evolve and grow. And we get Joel back next year. We're going to probably get a top draft pick this year. And I think all that, along with Coach Brown's coaching, we should definitely improve next year and be a better team.
Luke, as we talk, very competitive NBA finals taking place between the Warriors and the Cavaliers. What's your take on the series so far?
I think it's a very interesting series. You know, Cleveland is surprising everybody, I think, the way they've been playing. Obviously, I think the Warriors are the better team, but Cleveland just been grinding all the way into the injuries of Kevin Love and now with Kyrie, and they're doing it. You know, they got a lot of guys who are fighters and scrappers, but I think Golden State is still the better team. I think they still haven't played their best basketball. Steph Curry's been struggling. I think if they find a way to play and put together 48 minutes of good basketball, this should be the team to win this finals. But also, if Cleveland keeps playing like they're playing, right now they have the advantage. You know, it should be interesting to see. But I think at the end of the day, Warriors have still a better chance of winning right now.
LeBron has been just sensational in the series. I know you've guarded him before, Luke. Can you guard a guy like that? I mean, what's your mindset when you're matched up against him?
I've had my fair share of battles with LeBron. He's obviously, you know, the best player in the league right now. Very tough to guard, obviously, but I think he's very guardable. Right now, he's doing a lot of isolation basketball, and I think somehow the Warriors have to find a way to kind of take him out of the game, whether it's through a double team or something else, and make somebody else make plays, because I feel like when he's on the floor, he's the one making plays, whether it's scoring the ball, passing, or doing defensively even, you know, he always making the right play. But I feel like if the Warriors find a way to take him out of the game and make somebody else beat them, they will give himself a chance. But LeBron is definitely playing out of his mind, and it's great to see him do it in the finals for his hometown.
Luke, thank you very much for talking with us.
No problem, Sonny. It was a pleasure.
That's Luke Richard Baamute of the Philadelphia 76ers Basketball Club. And Luke was talking with me by telephone from the southwestern U.S. city of Houston, Texas. Luke gave us his thoughts on Cleveland Cavaliers star LeBron James. LeBron scored 20 points Thursday night in Game 4 of the NBA Finals. The Cavs star averaged more than 40 points a game during the first three games. Game 4 was not one of LeBron's better shooting nights. LeBron missed 15 of the 22 shots he took from the field. In Norway, an Ivorian sprinter showed off her speed and was one of the African winners at a big international track and field meet. The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Uma has that story as well as other sports news.
Ivory Coast's Muriela Hore clocked 11.03 seconds to carry the day in the women's 100 meters at the IWF Diamond League in Oslo, Norway on Thursday. Other Africans who won their events were Ethiopia's Genzebe Dibaba in women's 5,000 meters, along with Kenyan's Asbel Kiprop and Jaira's Kipchoge Birech in men's 1 mile and 3,000 meter steeplechase, respectively. South Africa's Anaso Jobodwana and Sunet Fulyun were runners-up in men's 200 meters and women's javelin, respectively, while Eritrean Awet Bibrab was second in men's 1500 meters. In rugby news, Zimbabwe host Kenya in an Africa Rugby Division 1A tie in Harare tomorrow Saturday. Earlier on, Namibia beat hosts Tunisia 22-14 in Nabuel in the other tie. Turning to football, Nigeria lost 1-0 to Germany at men's FIFA Under-20 World Cup in Christchurch, New Zealand on Thursday. Consequently, Mali and tournament debutants Senegal are the only Africans through to Sunday's quarterfinals. Mali engaged Germany in Christchurch as Senegal face Uzbekistan in Wellington. In Canada, African champions Nigeria Super Falcons play Australia in Winnipeg as Cameroon challenge defending champions Japan in Vancouver at the FIFA Women's World Cup today, Friday. Meanwhile, Guinea host Swaziland in Casablanca, Morocco at the start of the 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers today, Friday. Tunisia play Djibouti as Morocco encounter Libya. Tomorrow, Saturday, Cape Verde Islands engage Sao Tome and Principe. Uganda face Botswana. Nigeria play Chad, Zambia tackle Guinea-Bissau, Senegal play Burundi, Malawi host Zimbabwe, Algeria play Seychelles, Mali engage South Sudan, Angola face Central African Republic, as Burkina Faso engage Comoro Islands and South Africa play Gambia. Staying with the Nations Cup, Gabon welcome African champions Ivory Coast to Libreville as Ghana host Mauritius in Accra on Sunday. Egypt play Tanzania, Niger face Namibia, Equatorial Guinea engage Benin, Mozambique play Rwanda, Sudan meet Sierra Leone, Cameroon tackle Mauritania, Republic of Congo welcome Kenya, Togo engage Liberia, Ethiopia meet Lesotho, and the Democratic Republic of Congo encounter Madagascar. I'm Mark Oma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend.
Thanks, Mark, and you have a sporty weekend, too. And after hearing Mark run down all those fixtures, it's definitely a big weekend in terms of the qualifying competition for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations football tournament, which will be hosted by Gabon. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is at VOA Sunny Sports. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sunny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And today, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the final installment of a series on Johannesburg. And next, the government of Liberia discussing plans for building a national monument to remember the thousands who died of Ebola. But first, some music. Here is Fou Malade of Senegal with Ale Ale.
le champion. Sans coup de tête, cherche la balle. Même en défaite, fais pas de mal. Tactique, technique, applique, réplique, exit, public, footballistique. Food. Calme le jeu, mais pas le feu. Progress cool, pas le coup de boule. Chance d'esprit à tout prix. Saint-Sauve serein dans les terrains. Faut que ça cesse, le sang converse. Les supporters veulent pas la guerre. Plus de fair play, fais-moi le plaisir. Une tête saigne, une jambe casse. Polémique règne, tribune qui bouge. Saute sur pelouse, pêle-mêle dans l'aile. Tout le monde s'en mêle. Quand je te biffe, sors pas séduit. Sache comme tu rames, bon nom s'enclame. Histoire de race, faut qu'on dépasse.
Fou Malade of Senegal with Ale Ale.
Well, in recent years, the world has witnessed the rise of metrosexual. These are men mostly in cities who pay top dollar to look good. They spend hours grooming themselves and having intricate, expensive haircuts. But there's a business in Johannesburg, South Africa, that prides itself on being an old-fashioned, no-frills barbershop. It's one of the few left in the country. Darren Taylor reports in the final installment of a series on reminders of Johannesburg's past.
With a flick of a switch, Fred Moss's hair clipper is shaving the back of a client's neck. Unsurprisingly, the burly barber's silver-black hair is cropped closely. It's slicked back in a shiny wave. Moss has been working here at Scala Barbershop in the Johannesburg suburb of Melville for 45 years. The man in the white coat has cut generations of family's hair.
The grandfather comes here for many years, and then he used to bring his sons here. And then obviously when they got married and they had children, they bring their children here.
Moss's customers sit in adjustable seats made of cream-coloured porcelain and lackluster metal. Others are wood, with seats of red leather studded with brass. Two classic candy-striped barber poles line the shop's entrance. Moss's father started the Scala in the 1940s. He laughs when he remembers his dad forcing him to become a barber when he left school in 1968.
And I hated it. For the first year, I wasn't interested at all. And then I went off to the army and I came back, and that's when I realized, look, in for a penny, in for a pound.
Moss, an exuberant man with piercing blue eyes, threw all his energy into cutting hair, a job he still loves.
I absolutely enjoy it. I enjoy the people, I enjoy the company. We laugh every day. It's absolutely fun to cut hair.
Te wees as jy lees, hè?
Ja, nee, verseker. Het gee my nou daarom weer rede om ook bietjie te gesels.
Ja.
The barber talks with a customer who eases into a chair.
like I always say, I haven't got clients, I've got friends. Because we're like a big family here, you know, we talk about everything, we tell jokes, we discuss politics, we discuss sport.
Moss says his clients are extremely loyal.
They absolutely love my place because it's still the old school barber shop. There's no ease and graces, no appointments, no washing and no faffing, you know, so I think people really appreciate that.
Dr. Norbert Spitz certainly does. He moved to Johannesburg 2 years ago to work for a German non-profit.
And when I needed a haircut, I looked around and I discovered Fred's Salon. From my first haircut here, I was very satisfied and I like the ambiance, the atmosphere. It's very authentic. I get good service. Since that, I come here on a regular basis. I don't go anywhere else.
The silver blades of Moss's scissors flash as he cuts Spitz's hair at a surprising speed. It's cheap to get a cut at the Scala in comparison with those on offer at all the chic hair salons around Johannesburg. But Moss says his patrons include more than a few famous, wealthy South Africans.
For instance, the 95 Springbok World Cup champions. I used to cut just about the whole team, all their hair, before and after the World Cup. And then also I've got a lot of the local well-known actors that also comes to me.
And over the decades, the barber says he's had to give some haircuts he describes as plain weird.
I once did four bikers. I had to cut the Suzuki sign on the back of their hair. I've had strange things like that, but I don't like doing it because it takes forever, you know. It took me.
Moss says he adores his three daughters, but he wishes he had a son to take over the Scala barbershop the day he finally hangs up his scissors and clippers. He appears resigned to it closing for good in a few years' time.
I would love to see this place carrying on. I mean, after so many years, it would be a pity because it became such a landmark. You know, it's been shown on TV and newspapers and all sorts of things. It will be very hard so if it has to go eventually.
But for now, Moss is still doing what he does best, quick, easy and economic haircuts in a place where there isn't a metrosexual or a bottle of mousse in sight. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News at the Scala Barbershop in Johannesburg.
Liberia has been Ebola-free since the beginning of May. Now the government is discussing plans for building a national monument to mark the horrific time during which more than 4,000 Liberians died. One possible site is a cemetery outside Monrovia. It was built to get the crisis under control and symbolically stands for the magnitude of the epidemic. Benno Mutchler reports.
This is the cemetery at Disco Hill, an hour's drive from Monrovia. The place got its name from a disco that stood here until it was destroyed during Liberia's first civil war. The site was opened last December to bury Ebola victims safely and with dignity. When the Ebola crisis first broke out, Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf decreed that Ebola victims be cremated to get the crisis under control and stop one major cause of infection. This was a practice unheard of in Liberia. Worst of all, many victims' ashes were mixed together in the chaos of events, depriving relatives of the chance to say goodbye and commemorate their loved ones. At first, people believed the same would happen at Disco Hill.
People actually followed the drop-off cars to make sure that the bodies were not going to be disappeared, they're not going to be burned.
Matt Ward is the safe burial manager with the American NGO Global Communities, which is in charge of the cemetery. He says his 100-plus Liberian co-workers can be very proud of what they achieved.
Once people started coming and seeing that their loved ones were actually being buried as close to Liberian tradition and Muslim traditions as the health circumstances allowed, people became a lot less reticent. The whole objective was to be able to stop the cremations and get people away from clandestine burials to avoid their loved ones being cremated. So I think we've been very successful. That's a great feeling.
Many of those who were buried here were unknown. During the chaos, not everyone was properly identified upon admission or discharge from the hospital. During an outbreak, everybody has to be buried with safety precautions as a possible Ebola victim. Safe Burial manager James Espuendo says they often buried 8 to 9 people a day here. This pace and the stress of laying unknown people to rest, often babies, then coming home and seeing his own children at play, took a toll on him.
Even my wife was somehow afraid because Ebola is what we common saying that DV, if one girl, the whole family follows. So she was somehow afraid. When I even started where sometimes I go home, she somehow stepped the car to come around me.
Oh no, what I did is I noticed that this has a crack.
Matt Ward says he feels Disco Hill would be an appropriate site for a national memorial to the crisis. Not with marble crosses and a perfectly manicured lawn like Arlington National Cemetery outside of Washington, but like a conventional Liberian cemetery with cement casings and more wild-growing plants. Benno Müchler, VOA News, Margibi County, Liberia.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
An international public service announcement by the United States government.
In another sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on several top leaders of the Al-Qaeda-linked Somalia-based terrorist organization Harakat Shabab al-Mujahideen, or Al-Shabaab. The group, listed as a foreign terrorist organization since 2008, is battling that nation's government for control of Somalia and has also carried out a string of attacks in Kenya, most recently at a college in the town of Garissa. It is responsible for the deaths of thousands of Somali civilians, peace activists, international aid workers, journalists, and civilians, as well as African Union peacekeepers who are helping to restore stability and prosperity to the region. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes amid the fighting. Under the terrorist designation, the United States imposed financial and other restrictions on the group, blocking property and prohibiting U.S. persons from engaging in transactions with its members. Now the U.S. is offering rewards for information leading to the location of 6 of its leaders. Rewards of up to $5 million each are offered for information on the location of Ibrahim Haji Jama, also known as Abu Zalma, Fuad Mohammed Khalaf, a dual Somali and Swedish national, also known as Fuad Shungala, Bashir Mohammed Mahmoud, an al-Shabaab military commander believed to have been born between 1979 and 1982, and Mukhtar Robo, a 43-year-old who has served as an al-Shabaab spokesman and who carries an Eritrean passport. Rewards of up to $3 million each are offered for information on the location of 2 additional al-Shabaab leaders, Abdullahi Yare and the group's intelligence chief, Zakaria Ismail Ahmed Hersi, also known as Zaki Madobi. The United States guarantees all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these men, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.